Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Election news ahead of Tuesday's primary. That ballot includes a constitutional amendment about solar power that everyone can vote on.
Amendment 4, which provides property tax exemptions for renewable energy devices, is succeeding with about 68.8% of likely voters in the August primary.
Also on the ballot, a congressional race that's confusing some Tallahassee voters because the district line cuts right through their neighborhood.
I think somebody's done some rigging.
We'll also learn the latest on whether or not the president of Florida A&M University will get to keep her job and whether it's absolutely positively necessary for Florida third graders to pass a bunch of standardized tests before they can become fourth graders. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. A grassroots-only political strategy appears to be working as supporters await the fate of Amendment 4, the Florida legislature's tax-cutting plan for promoting solar energy. Jim Ash has that story.
One of the biggest problems with the Sunshine State is that it's not, at least not when it comes to turning all that sunshine into electricity. Florida has the potential to be the third largest solar generator, but it ranks 13 among the states. And that rankles environmentalists like Aliki Moncrief, executive director for Florida Conservation Voters.
Less than 2% of our power actually comes from the sun. And so I think that's something that most Floridians recognize is a little upside down.
Amendment 4 is designed to fix that. Simply put, Amendment 4 would cut property and equipment taxes to encourage more businesses and homeowners to switch to solar. The idea is such a no-brainer, Democrats and Republicans in the Florida legislature had no problem putting it on the ballot. More than 200 businesses and environmental groups are behind Amendment 4, so supporters didn't bother paying for an expensive TV campaign. The grassroots strategy is working, says St. Leo University pollster Frank Orlando.
Amendment 4, which provides property tax exemptions for renewable energy devices, is succeeding with about 68.8% of likely voters in the August primary.
Amendment 4 does even better, 70%, in the latest Florida Chamber of Commerce poll. That's comfortably above the 60% threshold for passing. But Moncrief isn't popping champagne corks just yet. Lawmakers put Amendment 4 on the August 30 primary ballot to avoid confusion with another campaign, and Moncrief says that's a problem. Florida is a closed primary state, but anyone can vote on the amendment.
We've had a lot of people ask, well, you know, I'm not registered as a Democrat or a Republican. Can I still vote in the primary? Because people think that it's a party thing.
The Yes on 4 website added a tool last week that helps people find their early voting sites. Moncrief says supporters hope that'll fix the problem.
You know, if every voter in Florida who supports solar showed up to the polls and cast their vote before August 30th in favor of Amendment 4, it would be a huge landslide of a victory.
Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's Susan Glickman says Amendment 4 sells itself because it blends environmental protection with economic growth.
The solar industry is creating jobs at 12 times the rate of the national average, and 1 in 83 jobs is in the solar industry.
But Amendment 4 supporters worry voters could get confused. The utilities are backing another solar initiative on the November ballot, one Amendment 4 backers oppose. Amendment 1 guarantees the right to own solar equipment. Critics say it's a Trojan horse that would sock solar users with higher utility rates. Glickman says Amendment 4 supporters are waiting before launching their Amendment 1 attack.
We are going to put our attention on next Tuesday, on August 30th, where voters will have a chance to reduce costs on solar, and then we will turn our attention to the other initiative.
Even a landslide victory won't seal the fate of Amendment 4. Lawmakers will have until 2018 to work out the details of the tax cuts. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
When Florida voters head to the polls on Tuesday and again in November, many will be voting in a new congressional district. Nick Evans and Kate Payne teamed up to look at what redistricting means for one Tallahassee neighborhood.
It's a hot, sunny afternoon in Tallahassee. I'm walking through Congressional District 5. It stretches from here all the way to Jacksonville. And demographically speaking, it leans pretty hard to the left.
But over here, literally right across the road.
I'm in District 2. It sprawls across 19 North Florida counties and picks up half of Tallahassee. And this district is much more Republican.
This is Branch Street.
It cuts right through a neighborhood called Levy Park.
Neighborhood of the year, 2013.
And for four blocks, this is the line separating District 2 from District 5.
If you live on one side, your representative will probably be a Democrat. But on the other, it'll probably be a Republican.
Branch Street has this classic neighborhood feel. The schools, the park, and the grocery store are all just a few blocks away. People know their neighbors, and the kids actually play outside.
Neighborhood. Oh, I'm so sorry. Jim Robert, will you wait just a second?
There are lots of little wooden houses called bungalows. Think front porches and screen doors. And some people on Branch Street are pretty surprised to hear they now live on the dividing line between two deeply partisan districts.
That makes no sense whatsoever.
This is Pam Jones, trying to make sense of the new district maps. Leon County used to be all in one congressional district, CD2, but the new CD2 spans the panhandle from Panama City to Ocala, picking up half of Leon County. The rest of the county is lumped in with Congressional District 5, which runs the Florida-Georgia line from Gadsden County to Jacksonville. CD5 leans hard to the left, CD2 hard to the right.
I think somebody's done some rigging.
Other neighbors are well aware of the changes. Steve and Penny Whitaker are Democrats, and they're happy to live on the Democratic side of the street.
Yeah, this street is the dividing line. Poor John on the other side.
But up and down Branch Street, the question keeps coming up. Why here?
Excuse me. Hi. He's very excited.
This is Isaac Miller and his dad, Henry.
I think it's silly. I mean, you know, I know my neighbors across the street a lot better than I know anybody in Ocala.
We actually spoke to Henry's neighbor across the street, Thomas Gast. Full disclosure, Thomas was one of my instructors in college. We just happened to knock on his door.
Obviously, the dividing line has to go somewhere, so I'm sure wherever you put it, people are going to be on the other side of the street being like, well, this is weird because it's my neighborhood. But since it is my neighborhood, it does seem particularly strange that such a small street like Branch Street would be the dividing line.
For the people on this street, poring over these maps that split their neighborhood in half, it feels arbitrary, careless even, and that undermines their faith in the system at large. One person we spoke to says those feelings are justified. Nick Quinton is a redistricting expert, and he lives on Branch Street. Seriously. He says this kind of redistricting doesn't mean voters get better representation.
Yeah, I think the argument that we're getting more partisan because of redistricting is entirely valid. I don't know how you get around it. And it blows my mind that we don't talk about that more than we do.
And for Quinton, the irony is everyone on Branch Street, Democrat or Republican, CD2 or CD5, they're all going to vote at the same polling place.
You know, we vote here. We vote at the church. And if you could get somebody at the church to talk to you.
Good morning. We're at 1609 Branch Street at the Family Worship and Praise Center.
This is Michael Fry. He's a church deacon, and he's been working elections here since 2004. And it's true. No matter which side of Branch Street a voter lives on, this is where they'll cast their ballot.
Yeah, we bought the building in 2003, so we've been here since 2004. And when we came here, this location was already established as a voting location.
Come August 30th, he'll be here early, making coffee, laying out snacks, and opening up the doors for poll workers. Residents living on opposite sides of the street find themselves in different districts, but they come together on election day at the local church. It's actually a bit of a nightmare for election supervisor Ion Sancho.
The map shows that the legislature drew a line right through an existing Leon County precinct. They've drawn the line right through it, and there's nothing that we could do except follow the line to create new precincts.
And on a map, he shows us Branch Street isn't the only place where the old precincts and new maps didn't quite line up.
This is what it looks like now. And you can see all of these little discrete, these are little carve-outs. Here, here, here. Again, we didn't even talk about the fact that Killarn Lakes is split.
It's complex, as in 612 different ballot styles in Leon County alone complex. And it just raises the question, why Branch Street? Why any of these streets?
So the short answer of it just comes down to race.
Race. That's Matt Isbell. He's a mapping expert who does a lot of work with groups aligned with the Democratic Party. What he's talking about is District 5, the one running from Tallahassee to Jacksonville. It's a minority access seat, which means the minority community needs to be able to elect a candidate of its choosing. But there's a fine line between minority access and minority packing. The Florida Supreme Court decided the Republican-controlled legislature crossed that line in 2012, and it sent lawmakers back to the drawing board. But Isbell explains there's another consideration that encourages district borders along small streets like Branch, and it's sort of the most fundamental tenet in elections.
The requirement that our districts have a population deviation of one.
One person, one vote. Isbell says this demand, that congressional districts be equivalent in population plus or minus one person, can actually force map makers to split neighborhoods, like Levy Park.
That creates a scenario where in order to get that number, which you normally are drawing these districts with census blocks, you have to basically find that one census block that's got 5 people or 10 people or this. And that's not just a census block, that's a neighborhood. That's like a community.
Supervisor Sancho says 115,000 Leon County voters will be in a different district this election. Another 7,000 will find themselves at a new polling location. There are 67 counties in Florida. It's not clear how many other branch streets there are strewn across the state, how many other Floridians will be voting in new districts. But Isbell suggests it could be more than a million. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
And I'm Kate Payne.
Still to come on Capitol Report, it seems Florida A&M University may very well be in the market for a new president before long.
I would think the smartest move would be not to launch a national search anytime soon.
And some Florida parents are pushing for the right to opt their kids out of having to take standardized tests.
It's not that we're opposed to testing, we're opposed to the high-stakes testing.
Florida A&M University could find itself with a large vacant office in the administration building by April. The school's governing board voted against extending a new contract to President Elmira Mangum. That move comes after Mangum received a lackluster evaluation. She's been under pressure almost from the start, at times sparring with trustees, alumni, and faculty. Lynn Hatter sat down with Florida Times Union Capital Bureau Chief Tia Mitchell about what's next for FAMU.
Tia Mitchell, you are the Capital Bureau Chief for the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville, and you're also a Florida A&M University grad. Full disclosure, I am as well. And this past week, there was a Board of Trustees meeting that pretty much had the effect of what appeared to be letting their president, Elmira Mangum, possibly go at the end of April. What led up to this decision?
This decision has been weeks, if not months, in the making, because the last time the Board of Trustees met, they were facing a deadline in which they needed to decide whether or not to renew Dr. Mangum's contract. And they decided to let that deadline pass with no action. And so that was the first indication that the Board of Trustees might be willing to allow the president to leave when the contract expires in April. But this meeting this past week was about her evaluation. And that was an opportunity if the Board of Trustees, you know, felt good after evaluating her and taking a step back to really gauge her performance to maybe decide to start those talks of keeping her. But what we saw at that meeting was there was not enough board support to keep her. And there was even indication that some board members were ready to part ways even before April.
And after the meeting, Dr. Mangum herself began talking about possibly a March 31st exit date. Where did her troubles with this board begin? Some would say that this probably started around exactly when she was hired.
Yes. It started almost immediately because Dr. Mangum, it's several things. Number one, this is her first time being a president. So she had a steep learning curve. Everyone knew that. But I think, you know, 6 months in, people started to complain. When I say people, board members began to complain that her learning curve was a little bit too steep and they didn't see the progress, particularly when it came to managing the politics of the job and the people skills part of a job. You know, being a university president is as much about academic offerings and student and faculty and budget management as it is about managing relationships and fundraising, being a figurehead in the community, and getting along with your board. Mm-hmm. And that's something Dr. Mangum has struggled with. Not so much, the board is very different than when she first got hired. So it's not so much that she has the personality conflicts with the board members as she had perhaps when she was first hired with certain board members. So the personality conflict has been mostly eliminated, but it still is the complaints from even the new board members that she doesn't communicate enough, that she's not transparent enough, and that she is not meeting their expectations as a president.
You know, when we start talking about the issue of relationships, I know, you know, a lot of people will hear that and think, well, that's kind of a subjective measure. This is a woman who, you know, by all accounts, is very accomplished. She did her doctorate in HBCU leadership. She previously worked at Cornell University in their finance. She was the head of their finance department. So some will say, well, we're judging her on relationships. That's really subjective. And I think it was Trustee David Lawrence, though, who said it during the meeting. He said, you know, it is the legislature that holds our purse strings. And if we can't form relationships with the people who hold our money, then we're really struggling. And that, you know, made me wonder, what are sort of the things that we value in a president? Do we value a president that has 40 years of hard higher education experience in budget and finance? Or do we really want in a university president someone who can, you know, in the words of David Lawrence, schmooze people?
And I think, so ideally you want a president who can do it all, or a president who understands their weakness and gets staff members who can help fill in the gaps where they're not strong. And so I think part of the criticism of Dr. Mangum is the places where she's weak, as outlined in her evaluation last year, that they don't believe she did enough to address those deficiencies. And so several trustees were saying, we're making the same complaints another year. And it's not just with relationships with the board members where Dr. Mangum is perceived as deficient. She's done all right with the legislature, but has she, you know, really built herself up as someone who's visible in the Capitol during the session? Not really. She has never quite won over the faculty, particularly the faculty senate and the faculty union, those faculty leaders on campus. The National Alumni Association, again, they do a lot of fundraising and things with the university, but is there a close relationship with the president's office? It doesn't appear to be so. Where she has excelled so far is with the rank and file students. I think that's
and if you look at her evaluation, I think she's received high marks on that. So it's, my perception is, it's not so much that Dr. Mangum has been a failure all around. It's that she's been perceived by the board as not excelling enough to justify a contract extension.
So what happens next? You know, right now, it does look like April 1, she may not be the university president, although it also appears that the board still left itself a bit of wiggle room with that. But how big of a challenge will it be for Florida A&M University to find yet another president after three presidents in the last decade, more if you count the interims?
Right. That is the concern, and I think that's why Board of Trustees members did take, you know, a cautious approach at the meeting. Instead of saying, let's part ways now or let's start a search now, they said, let's form a committee, let's figure it out, let's include Dr. Mangum on the committee, let's include different stakeholders and figure out a way to move forward, because they will meet again in September. So I do think that if Dr. Mangum's contract is not extended, the board will focus on an interim who might come from the inside, not necessarily hire an interim from the outside. And I think that interim will probably stay a while. I would think the smartest move would be not to launch a national search anytime soon. Perhaps what the university might do is select an interim that, if they're satisfied with, they might just keep permanent altogether.
Yes. Well, Tia, thanks so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter speaking with Florida Times Union Capitol Bureau Chief Tia Mitchell. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Pointing to concerns about increased chemicals going into Lake Okeechobee and nearby waterways, Martin County has filed a legal challenge to controversial new state water quality standards. The case, filed this week at the State Division of Administrative Hearings, is the fourth challenge to the standards, which were developed by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and approved last month by the Florida Environmental Regulation Commission. Other challenges have been filed by the Seminole Tribe of Florida, the City of Miami, and Florida Pulp and Paper Association Environmental Affairs, Inc. The standards, which are technically considered a proposed rule, involve new and revised limits on chemicals and waterways. The Department of Environmental Protection has said the plan, which remains subject to review and approval by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, would allow it to regulate more chemicals while updating standards for others. But Martin County pointed in part to concerns about additional chemicals going into the St. Lucie Estuary, which has been designated by the state as an impaired water body. Will Putnam, who managed his family's citrus and cattle business and was the older brother of State Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, died this week after a long battle with a rare form of pituitary cancer. The Ledger newspaper of Lakeland reported he was 51 years old. Will Putnam managed a business that included about 1,000 acres of citrus and more than 1,000 head of cattle. He was on the board of Florida's Natural Growers in Lake Wales, according to a story posted on the Ledger website. He died of heart failure at Tampa General Hospital on Thursday, and his wife Lee told the Ledger that the heart failure stemmed from his body breaking down after the fight with cancer. He was a lifelong resident of Bartow. Finally this week, can a student pass the third grade without taking a state-mandated standardized test? A Florida judge says yes. Regan McCarthy has more.
The morning Brandy Paternoster's twins were scheduled to start a test that's supposed to check their readiness to advance from third to fourth grade, Paternoster told her children to do something else instead.
They came to school on the morning of the test. They sat for the test. They signed their name on the outside of the booklet. They broke the seal and then pushed the test away.
Paternoster is part of a group of parents that sued the state to let their kids advance to the fourth grade without completing the third grade assessment test. Paternoster says the test is too high stakes for an 8-year-old. And while Beth Overholt's children are older, she echoes that sentiment.
It's not that we're opposed to testing, we're opposed to the high stakes testing. I have a daughter who's in high school and she does take her AP exams, her IB exams. She's taken the ACT, but there's no high stakes attached to those tests. Those tests are choices. She does not have to take those tests.
Overholt and Paternoster want the right for their kids to opt out of standardized tests. And while the discussion around the issue is growing, relatively few students are actually doing it. The Florida Department of Education says it's not an option. It doesn't track students who opt out, but it does count the number of tests that have been administered but not completed. Last school year, that accounted for less than 1% of students for most tests. A test could be started and not completed for a number of reasons. In some cases, that could be because parents have directed their students to opt out by breaking the seal on the test and pushing it away. But the third grade assessment is mandated by state law, and the Department of Education claims it's needed to protect against social promotion. But Paternoster argues there are alternatives. When she instructed her kids to push their test away in March, she expected the school to rely on a different procedure to judge her child's readiness, what's called a teacher-compiled portfolio.
The statute and the Broward County Progression Plan lays it out as a, I don't remember what all the exact specifics are, but work must be compiled, selected by the teacher. It must be classwork independently done in the classroom. It lists very specific guidelines as to the number of words and the amount of questions, etc.
But portfolios are typically used as a backup plan for students who take the exam but don't test well. And officials argue they can be subjective. However, a Tallahassee judge has ruled schools must consider other options for promotion, such as grades and portfolios, and can't hold a student back simply for failing to complete an assessment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.